CliffCentral.com.
All right, CliffCentral.com, Tuesday morning. It is just after 7 o'clock. I'm not going to talk about this for too long, but I got to refer to the fact that we saw a trailer for the Harry and Meghan documentary, which is coming out on Netflix, and it is bad. It is so, so bad. It's nothing short of an open declaration of war. I think mm-hmm. that if you watch it, you'll see it's all about like poor Meghan and poor Harry, and they even draw Princess Diana into it to try and make it look like Meghan was under threat of, you know, being taken out by the paparazzi or whatever. You know, there are lines like, no one knows the full truth. We know the truth. Prince Harry basically selling out the palace, calling them racist, all kinds of terrible things. You've got to think that, first of all, Harry is either the weakest human being or the most easily manipulated human being in all of history to turn on his own family like this. And Meghan has either the biggest victim complex in the world or she's the most manipulative human being that ever existed. But the fact that these two are busy selling this story on the back of, you know, kind of jumping out of the royal family and trying to pursue their own. They're really trying to make money off their documentary. They've signed away their honor and their dignity in order to make this thing. And it's just.
But Gareth, how else will they make money?
Yeah, I think you're right. This is their last shot, right? This is how they've got to. Because after this, no one's going to care anymore. I mean, after this, the story becomes old and boring and tired. And I don't think anyone's going to be interested in hearing from them anymore one day.
And now that Lisbeth is gone, that whole play that the royal family had, it has kind of diminished.
It has been diminished
among a lot of people.
Couldn't agree more.
Because she's always been that shining light that always brought the spotlight to the family.
Yep.
She's gone. We really don't care that much anymore. And Meghan and Harry do know that as well. And they're just trying to cash in one last time before the pump gets dry.
It's just very, very sad. And just watching, I mean, like the trailer's probably, 30 seconds or whatever, but it is so bad. And you just, it leaves you with such a bad taste in your mouth at the end of it, too. Really, I can't say there's anything about it that makes me want to watch it. And they've got a narrative. Apparently, people are already picking apart the trailer, saying that there are shots from the trailer that were taken from other people and the paparazzi, not even Harry and Meghan. And there were pictures being taken on their South African trip where apparently they had arranged for photographers to stand in certain places and make it look like they were taking these terrible pictures of them. So they were already formulating this plan long before they left the royal family. They'd already come up with a plan to destroy and dismantle as much as they could on their way out. I mean, it's just unreal that this is how destructive these two are.
These two are absolute nutcases. And with Meghan being such a pedantic narcissist, she is absolutely a narcissist. I mean, I know you've talked about her podcast as well previously, where she makes everything about her. I mean, imagine talking to Serena Williams and you make that about yourself. So that alone taught me. And Serena Williams is the guest.
Mm-hmm.
She has guests and she turns all the conversations back to her. So she's an absolute narcissist. Mm. And I think Harry is a bit of a pushover. Sometimes I do feel like she bullies him quite a bit.
But what a pathetic guy to allow that to happen. It's just, it seems to me like this is just, you know, all we need to know. And this documentary isn't going to reveal just what they want us to see, which is like obviously to turn it into a poor Meghan and poor Harry. Their lives are so hard and they've had such a tough time and they're so rich and they're so royal and everybody's so interested in them. But it's like everyone else is also the victimizer. You know, they've all been so mean to us. But what they're really going to see, and I think people who do watch this documentary who are fans of Meghan and Harry, might just break through the noise and actually see two people who are totally self-absorbed and who have no scruples and who are trying to pull down everything around them because they can't build a damn thing themselves. Let's see. Let's see what happens.
Gareth, what is this documentary called? What did you say the documentary is called again? The Cash Grab. The Final Cash Grab.
Yeah. Take, what was that? The Trolley Dash. You know that game that people used to play where they'd take the trolley through the shop and just try and load as much shit as they could into the trolley? Oh, man. Unbelievable.
They know full well that this is their final opportunity. Nobody's going to give a shit after this. So I think they must milk it for all it's worth. Yeah. They really should.
Well, let's see. Carl says, I legit care about my neighbor's kid's artwork more than Harry and Meghan. Could not give a tiny fuck about these two Muppets. Yeah.
You have it.
Well, let's see.
Those two are absolute bad cases.
Let's see what happens. That's the story in the news today. So the other thing that I wanted to talk about and something that you got on the agenda is like the OnlyFans thing, which again, Simpiwe brought up with us, I think, the other day. And we also spoke. Jeez. Yeah, we spoke about this. I think Leanne also brought it up too. Like these OnlyFans people are doing a TV show now on Showmax. And, and I think, you know, you actually have been on here. Simpiwe actually brought up, like, we've got to pay more attention. We've got to actually see what this is all about. How big do you think it is in South Africa, Mash? Because we know people are making serious money all over the rest of the world. And I know people are interested. They're curious about this, even if they haven't joined or subscribed or any of that stuff. You can tell us.
Gareth, it is huge. It is much bigger than people actually want to believe. Mm-hmm. This is a multi-million dollar, not even rand, dollar industry. People are making a lot of money off of this. Hence, I joined as well. Of course, I'll never share my handle on the show, because I don't want people I know ever finding it, of course. Yeah, has a completely different name, a completely different Twitter account to promote it as well.
Okay.
But what I can share is that, so some of the people on this new show on Showmax are my friends.
Hmm.
They actually are my friends, and I've been talking to them. I've known them for quite a number of years. Yes. So that's where I also got that woman, that oomph to actually join in on the action. These guys are making a lot of money, and to top it off, they're actually just having fun while doing it. It's not as hectic as those BTS videos you see on Twitter whenever they show BTS of sex work and all of that.
Yeah.
It is quite a fun sort of job, but it is a job at the end of the day. So they always have to deliver. And yeah, I mean, it is fun. It is vibes. And these guys are just living their best lives while doing it. But once I actually found out how much they're making, that was when I got that final push to just, you know what, try it out, see how it goes. Starting out is a bit tough, because one thing about OnlyFans I've actually learned is that, for starters, you're not selling your body. You're actually selling your identity.
Sure.
That's how people actually get to engage with you more. So nobody, because one of the guys from the show actually told me was that there's 1,000 other people on this damn app who have the same body as you.
Yeah.
But if you're not showing your face, there's one thing that's different about you from all of them, and that's your face. And if you're not showing your face, nobody's watching. They want to see your face.
Yeah, because you see, I think a lot of people reckon, oh, well, I could probably do this if I don't have to show my face. But you don't show your face, no one's going to subscribe to you, right? Because Exactly. It's actually about like getting to know this person and everything about them. It's like it's a bit psycho, if you ask me, because it doesn't sound to me like a very healthy way to kind of make long distance or virtual relationships work. Because that's what I think a lot of these people think it is. It's like a way for them to get closer to the people that they admire. But yes, you have to let it all hang out, and we're not just talking about the junk.
Yes, people do want to see your face, and they do want to get to know you. And I see that Simpiwe actually commented here in the comments, how much money have you made so far?
she's going straight forward. Simpiwe is probably, she's got the most interesting questions for you. We should do it on the show where the two of you are on there together.
So far I've made not so much. Honestly, as I said, I'm not promoting it as much, or rather I'm not promoting it on my main social media pages. I made social media pages for it. So starting from scratch completely, and on the pages, I'm really not showing my face either. So I haven't made too much. I've made just about $600. Okay. So it's not a lot, and it's not little either.
But
so
you are
a decent amount of money.
You're dipping your toe in that world. So you're testing
it
out.
Yes, I am.
And these friends of yours.
I'm just testing it out.
These friends of yours who you know, who are on this TV show, they're making serious money?
They're making serious money. One of them just even came back from Brazil to go shoot some content.
Shit.
Yes, they're making serious bank. Serious bank. The other one is always trending on Twitter. Everybody's always talking about her, always getting all up in her business. She does OnlyFans with her mother. This other girl. Her name is Samke. I can say their names on the show.
Sure.
Samke does OnlyFans with her mother. Hmm. And I don't know who got who into it, but they do actually do content together. I think they also do hookups together and all of that. But yeah, I mean, honestly, if I was a mom and I saw my daughter making bank like this, I'll jump on as well.
Those bumpsters in the Gambia we were talking to JJ about should start doing this too. They could probably make even more money. $600 is 12K. That's not bad at all, says Carl. Yeah, that's not bad.
That's a decent amount of money. Yeah, sure. It's my little piggy bank.
For not promoting it, I think that's impressive. No, because I have seen, you know, basically in the social media stuff, that there are a couple of girls in South Africa and a couple of guys in South Africa who are doing this now. And they're open about it. They're like, here I am. Subscribe if you want. Anyway, I suppose everybody, like we were talking about the criminals earlier who are trying to make money and the people who are trying to work hard every day. This is just another way to work hard and make money.
Mm-hmm. Work hard indeed, and it is a fun industry to be in, and it's not something I would ever do full time, honestly. No. But it is fun to just dip my toes in, see exactly how it works, the mechanics of it, and just having people who are already exposed to this world, educating me and guiding me throughout the way, has been lots of fun. That's been really fun. But to just drop everything and start doing this all the time could never be me.
Well, Natasha says, as a single mom, I've given some serious thought, but the thought of my daughter doing it puts me off completely. I want so much better for her. Yeah. And of course, the fact that, you know, your kid's going to grow up one day, and as I think it's Congo Christmas. That's changed. That's nice. Congo Christmas says, one day you'll have to explain to your kids why there's so many photos of your poo-poo on the internet.
You might not. You might not. Well, on the show, one of the girls' mothers actually confronts her. Uh-oh. And straight up says to her, so people are sending me stuff of you.
Hmm?
And it's stuff that is very unflattering. I don't know what the hell is going on. I don't know what the hell you've been up to. But I'm getting all of this. What the hell is going on?
Hmm?
And this girl is like, Mom, listen, I gotta do what I gotta do. You know, I want to build you that house. I want to actually give you a better life. And yeah, this is the only way I can do that, because you know the country we're living in. You know that it's hard even finding a job around here. So she just straight up said that to her mom. And her mom was actually quite understanding, although you know how parents are.
Sure.
She turned it around and basically reflected on herself. She's like, people in the community are going to say that I'm a whore because my daughter's doing this kind of stuff. And it's like, huh? What? How does that even work? But either way, the mother doesn't have a choice. I mean, it's your daughter. You have to accept it at some point.
Carl says he's going to start an OnlyFans account, but he starts off naked and then people pay him to put his clothes back on because he's fat. Now, there's a clever idea.
It's Carly, you know. But I always say everybody has their own yam. You'll be surprised. I mean, people do pay to watch people poop, scat. It's called scat.
Jesus, really?
So, Carl, you have a target market out there.
Oh my God! You know what? Rather, Carl, you put your clothes back on, and people will pay you for that, and then you can say you earned some money out of that. That's good. There's a lady on the interwebs that eats seafood, but mainly crabs. It's mukbang. Eats like a slob, but then over $1 million a year, says Arbot. Yeah, I remember we spoke to that mukbang.
Yes.
Star, in inverted commas. Remember?
Yes, I remember. Yeah. The mukbang people are also making bank. I mean, Simpu has been wanting us to mukbang a lot. In fact, every time we eat, they set up cameras. they set up a whole bunch of cameras. They're like, yeah, maybe one day we should go live as well.
Oh, you're joking. Like, really?
Straight up. We have tons of footage of ourselves eating. It is so odd. I'm like, I don't want that out there. But if you guys want to post it, cool. Let's make $1 million.
So, Simpiwe, since we're talking about her, she says, what's your timeline? How do you think you'll, how long do you think you'll be on the platform? And is there a way out? Like, can you just shut down your account when you've had enough?
You can. It is as easy as that, Gareth. So, for me, I am kind of saving up for a couple of things. So I'm doing it really for that. Once I have the stuff that I want to actually buy, then I'm done. Then I'm pretty much done with it. But my target at the moment with OnlyFans is to make at least $3,000. At least $3,000. And I want to make it. So I've been on OnlyFans for a couple of months now. I've been on for about 4 months so far, 3-4 months. So my target is to make that within at least 12 months. If I don't reach it or reach it, I'm leaving it.
Is there a community? Like, does everyone on OnlyFans know who the other people on OnlyFans are?
Well, because I do know some of the creators personally, for me, it's a bit of a tricky one. So I don't know the other people. I do not subscribe to many other people, just my two friends.
Okay.
That's it. But I don't even watch their content. Hey? I'm just subscribed as a supporter, just to show them, like, I'm actually supporting. I'm actually seeing your content. And I'm not screen recording it or screenshotting it and sharing it with the world. That is most important.
But how do you promote this stuff without giving away your identity?
So I have multiple Twitter accounts. I have many Twitter accounts. I have quite a number of Facebook accounts, Instagram accounts as well, but in particular, the Twitter accounts. These are Twitter accounts with very odd names, with a whole different picture. Still a picture of me, but you can't even tell because it's blurry and all of that. But the point is that it's me, still me, still a real person. I'm not catfishing, but I'm not showing my face. So nobody, I don't share it with anyone because my biggest fear has always been people screen recording this stuff and screenshotting this stuff and sharing it with the world. And I've been there before. I mean, a few years ago, I did actually share a picture of myself in a Speedo for, testicular cancer campaign. Okay. And that kind of went viral, because I didn't have the best body. So people were attacking me. That went viral. Everybody was talking about that. And I thought to myself, if that can go viral, imagine what this would do. So I keep it completely separate. That's the way you should be doing it. And I see in the comments, VUT Zarko is just absolutely terrified by all of this. Like, no, man, that's wrong.
Yeah.
So, it is what it is. It is what it is. So one thing that the OnlyFans creators always say, though, is that if you're going to judge, are you paying my bills? You know, this is what the creators usually say.
I do get that. So this is really for Simpiwe's good. She wants to ask a final question. She's busy this morning. How do you deal with the judgment of having an OnlyFans account? You've already kind of answered that by saying, you know, you're not paying my bills. And that's what a lot of these creators say. And obviously that's true for anybody. You know, if you are, let's say you're doing a really terrible job, you're working, you know, 9 to 5 in a salt mine. Nobody's coming to save you. No one's in any position to judge you. You're the one who has to decide on your future, and you're the one who has to decide, this is what I'm going to do. But how do you deal with it? Because you're kind of, you know, you're one of these fun, energetic young guys who's got like a lot of really big dreams for yourself. And a lot of people will say, oh, well, you're ruining your potential for the future. What would you say to those people?
Nothing's being ruined because, first of all, it's a completely separate account. Nobody knows. I've been on social media long enough to know very well how to actually separate social media completely or an account completely from the personal. But if it were ever to come out, I think I'll just keep it moving. The judgment and all of that, as I said previously, doesn't pay nobody's bills. Yeah. People will always judge. Even people judge when you're doing good.
That's right.
People judge when you're doing
good.
Like, people always find a reason to judge everything you're doing. So judgment is just a part of life. It's not going anywhere anytime soon. And it's something that we just have to learn to live with. Everybody judges. Everybody judges. You know, especially when people go like, I don't want to judge. You're going to judge.
Yeah.
You're going to judge.
In fact, normally those are the worst ones.
Those are the worst judges. So, or the people say only God can judge, only God. It's like, oh, they're about to judge everyone. So, it's something that you do get used to. And I'm sure you know very well, Gareth. I mean, as someone who's been in the limelight for so long, you know that you do get over it at some point.
Yeah, listen, I think a lot of people have to just decide for themselves what they will and won't do. And I've mentioned before how I think everyone is going to eventually there's going to be so much nudity on the internet that people are just going to go, oh, well, you know, it's back to the Garden of Eden here. Because if you want to see some celebrity naked, you just have to type in their name and you'll find something.
Absolutely. There's something out there about everyone.
And then it's not going to be a big deal.
It's not. It's not. It really isn't that much of a big deal as is. It's just, you know, well, it's only a big deal when, I suppose, when people want to expose you and people have a certain narrative they want to push of you.
Maybe.
Like Zanele Sifuba.
What is Zanele Sifuba? Oh, yeah, of course, because she was the Speaker of the Free State Parliament, right? And then,
yes.
And then there's some Nigerian dude who was trying to extort money from her or something.
Yes, it was that one. Yeah. So if people do have a certain narrative, people are trying to blackmail you, if people are trying to make you look negative in the light or paint you in that bad light, mm-hmm. then they will do just that.
Yeah.
They will do just that. And there's nothing we can do about that, no matter what you're doing.
Yeah, I just wish, I mean, you know, it's really, this doesn't particularly upset or offend me at all. But I just think there are mean people who will go out of their way to like get involved in someone else's business. So if someone is busy, like these friends of yours who are now in this documentary, now that they've put it all out there, no one has any power over them, right? I mean, now good luck to anyone who's going to try and like blackmail or extort them, because they've let it all hang out, literally, figuratively, and now in a documentary series. So they're kind of unbreakable at this point. They've just got to be okay to deal with it psychologically themselves. That's really all.
Yes. And it's a thing of you'll only trend once. And after that, everybody's over it.
Oh, that's
true. Everybody's moving on with their lives.
Well, whether it's some controversy, mm-hmm. you know, there's always some new controversy on the internet. And now it's going to be like Harry and Meghan. The next thing, it's going to be some person who's crying, you know, racism or transphobia or whatever it is. The next thing, it's going to be someone naked. It really, and people move on like this. They don't care.
Yeah, I mean, look, never stays. You've already forgotten about Belinda Magor.
Who?
Belinda Magor. I think Belinda Magor.
Who's that?
Gareth, you weren't following the story.
Uh-uh.
It's a woman who actually a WhatsApp voice note that she sent leaked of herself saying, and I don't want to misquote her, but she said something about something really racist, like super racist. It was like really bad.
Oh.
I'm actually just looking for it right now. Is it Belinda Magor?
Jeez.
Yeah, Belinda Magor. And she actually ended up being charged. So I'm just looking for her tweet quickly. I think I'll find it just now. Biggest.
She faces 3 years in jail over a racist pit bull rant.
Yes.
Okay, well, all of these stories are like behind a paywall, but maybe you've got the details there. I didn't even know this story had happened.
It trended like in November, towards end of November, so around early last week. So Belinda Magor has been arrested in South Africa after she was recorded saying all black men should be killed and all black women's wombs should be cut off. She also said animals are better than black people. And this is something that trended pretty much the whole week. Jeez. And she said this on a voice note. So there's no backtracking. There's no saying it was photoshopped. It was a voice note with her voice on it. And one thing that also got people a bit further outraged was our poor old friend Karen Morn goes on Twitter and says that, no, you know, people with diabetes don't know what they're saying sometimes. You know, yeah, she has diabetes. So people with diabetes. Mm. And I was like, wait, what do you mean? Mm. And I do follow her. I do, you know, she's posted one of my videos on her feed.
So then Karen is now also in trouble because she said this, like she's making excuses for racists.
Yeah, because people are attacking her with that whole narrative of like you're always biased.
Mash, I was happier before you told me about this Belinda McGaw story. Now you've made my life less fun, not more fun. So thanks very much for that.
It is an absolute pleasure.
I was doing so well. I'd avoided that story until now. I could have gone all my life without even knowing this name, and now you've gone and put it in my vocabulary, in my brain.
Well, we know what name to chant when we protest outside the courthouse later this year, or rather early next year.
Yeah,
this woman is a terrible human, and we don't want her in the streets either way.
All right. Well, listen, that's all we got time for this morning, except that we also have a new episode and the final episode of Blind History for you. And today is a particularly poignant day to do this because it marks the day back in 2013, which doesn't feel so long ago, but it is. It's almost 10 years ago that Nelson Mandela died. And he is the subject of this episode of Blind History. So it's all very apt. And here it is, really a difficult episode to do because this man is still within living memory for so much of you know, the country, for so many people in South Africa, and an incredible human being who I think history will continue to attribute a whole lot of credit, honor, and glory to as time goes by. There have been people who've tried to pick him apart and to say that he was a sellout and he didn't do enough and all that kind of thing. But I do think that in the long span of history, the books, the authors, the historians will be favorable to Nelson Mandela. And I think it's a great thing to include him in season 7. We try to end each season on a big name, and that's certainly what we're doing here. So take a look. Here is Nelson Rolihlahla Mandela, who is the subject of today's Blind History. I hope you're having an awesome day so far. Stick around. CliffCentral.com will keep you company all the way through your day. There's plenty of fresh stuff for you to listen to and take part in, and we want to hear from you. So drop us a message in the YouTube comments or send us a WhatsApp, and we will include it in the show. Enjoy the rest of your Tuesday. Here's Blind History, Season 7's finale.
Mr. Nelson Mandela will, within seconds appear, and that will be the moment the world has been waiting for.
In the heat of the summer of February 1990, a man walked out of prison and into a new world. Nelson Mandela, his one hand clasped in that of his wife Winnie and the other raised to the sky, took his first steps as a free man.
There's Mr. Nelson Mandela, a free man, taking his first steps into a new South Africa.
He would go on to become president of a democratic, free South Africa, an icon the world over, and an inspiration to so many. When he died in 2013, he had become the father of his nation and the most famous man in the world. Well, it is the final episode of this season of Blind History, and we always try to end the season on a big person. I think last time we ended it on Jesus Christ. That's, you know, we're not messing around. So this episode, and we've had a lot of people asking for an episode on this guy, and I was always a little bit careful and cautious because history is something that you need a little bit of distance to be able to evaluate. There's no doubt that this person is one of the greatest people who ever lived, and especially in the context in which you and I find ourselves, Ant, South Africa. Yeah. Nelson Mandela. I know you've been very keen to talk about him too. The audience have been asking, where's your episode on Nelson Mandela? And it has been a glaring hole in the story. And in South Africa, he's probably the most famous person who's ever lived in this country.
He's the one that's made the most difference.
Absolutely. So there's a lot of pressure to do this one right. He's also the first person we've ever featured in Blind History that I've actually met. And for that reason, it's very hard to be objective like we have with all the others. Mm. You know, I can say, oh, well, wasn't it great when, you know, Napoleon did this, or wasn't it awesome when Caesar crossed the Rubicon? And I can be a little bit interested, but I didn't actually know them. And in this case, I can't claim to have known him well, but I certainly met him a few times. And I think all of us have some picture in our minds, if you've been alive for more than 10 years, of who this man was. Mm. I mean, he's still on our money.
You know, we've said in a few of our episodes, what would you do if you could go back to, let's say, Alexander the Great's tent and ask him something?
Yeah.
And in this instance here, like you mentioned, Gareth, you might have had that opportunity to ask him something, you know, in the past, because you spent whatever time with him or you met him a few times. So that's definitely something really special.
Well,
because in 200 years' time, 300 years' time, people will still be talking about him.
Oh, absolutely. So he was born, obviously, in the Eastern Cape in Kruno, actually born in Mvezo. And Mvezo is just a little way away from Kruno, where his grandson, Nkosi Zwelivilile Mandla Mandela, now runs that tribal and hereditary chieftainship. Nelson Mandela was born as a Xhosa aristocrat. So he grew up in a family that was quite prominent. His parents and grandparents were well known. He could recite his family history. And I heard his grandson do this orally, going all the way back to the first Abatembu chief. So this is a long and very beautiful story of a nation that started in the 1700s and possibly before, but certainly then.
And it seems, Gareth, that his early childhood was quite calm.
It was a rural, bucolic, kind of idyllic childhood. You know, he was a herd boy, like Correct. So many kids who were, their first job effectively was to look after the livestock, which were also the economy of the family. And he did go to school early, primary school in Kruno, where he met Miss Mdingane, and she was the one who called him Nelson because he needed an English or
a
white
Western
name.
Or, yeah, exactly.
But, I mean, his real name was Rolihlahla.
Yeah.
And obviously this Christian name stuck. And he was named after Horatio Nelson, who we've covered in this season.
Yes, brilliant. And aptly. But his name, his Xhosa name, I've just read that it was referring to a bent tree or troublesome as such.
Well, certainly not someone who will take nonsense lying down.
That's
kind of the idea.
Yeah.
And certainly this guy, by all available evidence, was not someone who would be pushed around.
Exactly.
He obviously continued his education and actually went to a Wesleyan secondary school of some repute, matriculated there, studied a Bachelor of Arts degree at the University of Fort Hare, and went on to study law. And eventually, I mean, we're passing through some important stuff here, but set up a law firm as one of the first black lawyers in Johannesburg. And it was Mandela Tambo Lawyers,
the
sign.
Tambo.
You could still see photographs of the sign on the original building in Johannesburg. And they started taking on cases which were obviously important to him and to Oliver Tambo, who's another person we have to do a whole episode on. But it's pretty damn amazing how much got going so early in this guy's career and how he already knew at that point what I think his destiny would be.
Mm.
He was going to be someone who fought for the underdog.
Yeah.
He was going to be someone who stood up for his people.
And that was, you mentioned the law firm, that was around 1952. And I think that 1948 was where the shit hit the fan with the policies of the
Correct.
Of the nationalist government.
Right.
And so his offices, his law firm was there to protect, you know, and he saw it firsthand. And I think effectively that's really started to build up the anger, you know, in him and the passion in him to, especially the pass laws. And later on, you know, they were onto him. You know, effectively they closed that. How many times did the security police come in and close their practice down?
Absolutely.
Et cetera. But that's where effectively 4 years after apartheid and officially with the name apartheid was brought on.
Well, I mean, this was the big enemy of anyone who was for freedom, for you know, universal suffrage. And the ANC had been a party that had been established in the early 1900s. Mm. And we've spoken a little bit about some of the leaders, the early leaders of the ANC, but he was really, Nelson Mandela was the one who founded the ANC Youth League all those years ago. And he adopted at that point a much more mass-based and more radical policy than the rest, the program of action they kicked into gear in 1949. So this is all concurrent with his legal practice. And he, by then, had been married to Walter Sisulu's cousin, Evelyn, who was a nurse. They had two sons and two daughters, both of who died in infancy. But he and his wife divorced, that first wife, in 1958.
Yeah.
You know, by then, he was very much a political figure.
Yeah. And I think that that was partly the challenge created in the marriage, was that he was really fighting, like you said, a political figure. He went to jail for 9 months. So he wasn't at home a lot. She thought he was having affairs with ANC, the people within the
women,
ANC,
yeah.
Women in the ANC. You know, it's very difficult to, I suppose, in those early years, and also how we feel, but he belonged to the people, if that makes any sense. And it's tough being married to, in that situation, somebody that belongs to the people. I mean, it's just...
You got to... Everything else comes second, right?
Agreed, 100%. So I think that probably had a lot to do with it as well.
Yeah, and there are lots of people who talk now about Mandela's personal life, and I think he was actually pretty tidy about what he did. You know, a lot of the great people in history have the most messy personal lives. Mm. And certainly when Winnie comes along later on, he put his foot down and said, no, this is not acceptable. You know, this is post prison, obviously, but let's just rewind the clock for a moment. So going back, he became a restricted person and was banned for the first time in 1952, which you've mentioned already. And then he had to watch in secret as they adopted the Freedom Charter at Kliptown in 1955.
Which he was part of.
He was, but he wasn't allowed to be, you know, and the government were really, they had their sights set on him. He was already, I think in the same year, he was charged with the Suppression of Communism Act and their partner campaign on that front, which was obviously controversial. And he was sentenced to 9 months of hard labor. They could do that in those days. So he'd already had a stint where he was under close observation and in prison. And now they were watching him like a hawk.
Yeah.
And this is when the treason trial comes along.
Yeah. If we have to just look just during 1952, so intermittently banned, so they were like exactly like you said, they were on his back. And just imagine restricted travel, but also restricted speech.
Oh, yeah.
So it's everything against
all communication.
All communication. And they were harassing all the anti-apartheid activists. And 100% what you did, he went on trial. And I mean, but I think the trial was just a joke.
Well, it was, because ultimately all the 28 accused were acquitted. And that was in 1961. But men and women of all races found themselves there being tried. And obviously, the famous Sidney Kentridge was the man who stepped up and made the defense. And it was something that the apartheid government didn't expect. They thought their judges would do their bidding, you know, just like current politicians think the judges will do their bidding. But judges, the best ones, operate individually and independently and make decisions based on the law. But there was the Sharpeville massacre in 1969.
1960. Gareth, this was the big turning point as well, because I mean, you can see definitely throughout his life, and even, you know, when he came back out of prison, he was a pacifist. He was non-violent. He wanted to work through things in a non-violent manner. But after the massacre in 1960, then he realized he's not going to get anywhere with the incumbent regime without more aggressive campaigns. So, and then he started to upskill himself, and he went into Africa, and look, he had to sneak around. I mean, they were onto him, and I think they called him during that time, a lot of people, because he kept evading, they called him the Black Pimpernel. So, because they could never find him, but he was on the continent. I don't know if he went offshore, but he was definitely up in Algeria where he was trained in guerrilla tactics and all of those things. And it's very much against his soul.
Well, I mean, there's a lot of controversy around this too, because this is where his reputation of freedom fighter versus terrorist becomes the talking point, which people are still debating. And obviously that's where the line, one man's freedom fighter is another man's terrorist, comes from. But he helped establish Umkhonto we Sizwe at this point.
Correct.
You know, we've also got to remember that South Africa was under a state of emergency. There were lots of things going on. There was the banning of the ANC at that point and the banning of the PAC. There were people detained constantly for whatever reason. So it wasn't clear when you would get into trouble with who. You could be saying something. You could be sending a letter. You could just be arrested at any time for being part of this insurgency, as the old government called it. And it was at this point that he met Winnie and married her, in 1958. And they had two daughters, famously Zenani and Zindi. They divorced much later in 1996, but she remained his companion through all those years that followed, the trials and tribulations of what took place next. But in the face of all the mobilization, that was where he decided it was time to take on these slightly more guerrilla tactics, which you mentioned earlier. And under the guise of Umkhonto we Sizwe, they arranged explosions and bombs were put in certain places. And it was basically civil disruption.
Yeah.
And obviously people were killed at this point. This gave the government the opportunity to finally bring him to trial.
Yeah. So, and actually it wasn't a long period of time that he had the opportunity, you know, to go on to, change this tactic, because he was locked up very soon afterwards. But, they also found a cache of ammunition in Rivonia. So the writing was on the wall. And then he made a decision, or he always knew that he's going to stand up, accept everything, and just, he's going to tell it like it is. And I think that, you know, one of his famous speeches, you know, I'm prepared to die.
Yeah.
That all happened. And, during that type of period, it's insane what happened in those days.
Well, this is where he became, first of all, in the eyes of the old regime, notorious, but in the eyes of the people, a hero. So this is where he went to trial. Luckily, he was spared the death penalty. But he was sent off to Robben Island. And really, this is where it becomes almost legendary, because the last picture you see of him is in the 1960s. And then he becomes this enigma for 27 years, where nobody knows anything about him, only the government. They control very strictly who's allowed to go and see him. He's writing letters. He's very much involved. This is a man who's studious beyond belief. He spends his days talking, trying to work things out, trying to understand how politics works, trying to figure out the dynamics of the other prisoners on Robben Island. He's also doing hard labor, mining, you know, in the quarry there.
Yeah, and his eyes were
permanently damaged as a result of that, which was one of the reasons why in the times I met him, there was no flash photography allowed, because
it was a proper hard labor.
It was awful. Robben Island was really awful. And, you know, this involves obviously his arrest in Howick, where there's now a monument, Lily's Leaf Farm here just down the road from us, Robben Island, and later on, Drakenstein Prison, where he ended up. But this is really the legendary part of his story.
Yeah, and the core celebrity, that's where it came from.
Absolutely.
And if you think of the support that he garnered, around the world. So we, Gareth, like you, I'm a little bit older though, but, we grew up in this transition and effectively. And if we traveled, and if I went to London, there was always some sort of, peaceful, not strike, but, you know, demonstration at
protest.
South Africa House.
Free protest. Mandela.
It was almost permanently at Trafalgar Square, and wherever they were, there were concerts being held, and, you know, just incredible things. Even things named after him when he was in prison. You know, like a nuclear particle was named after him while he was in prison. It was just, there was just that massive support. And I mean, it took the guys, the regime, a while to see that this tidal wave was coming.
Yeah, well, you're exactly right. Meanwhile, while he was in prison, his mother died in 68, his eldest son in 69. He couldn't attend either funeral. They'd never let him out. Eventually went to Polsmoor and then to Drakenstein. And he started discussing things with the government. I think they realized the writing was on the wall, and it was a ticking time bomb. And the first government's meetings with Mandela occurred somewhere in the late '70s, early '80s, you know, because they realized also this is, you can't keep a lid on this thing. Mm. It's going to explode. The whole world is against you.
Yeah.
And ultimately there've got to be decisions made. There was obviously the referendum, which took place, the unbanning of the ANC. And then bada bing, bada boom, you got like Nelson Mandela is about to be released. Big announcement by F.W. de Klerk. Obviously, and we could go into this in some detail, but there were secret meetings being held between P.W. Botha and Mandela, the justice minister and various members of the ANC, and lots of these clandestine things that happened in order to bring about a more peaceful change and to avert at all costs civil war. Because the apartheid government, while they were managing certain things and they could keep a lid on certain things, there were other things that were getting out of control. Mm. The economy, international pressure, the number of allies they had was shrinking by the day.
There was heavy sanctions.
Yeah, massive problem.
It was crippling, but also if you couldn't control him, because they really, like you mentioned, in the '70s, they said, look, we'll release you, but on condition that you accept the status of like Transkei. Remember they made those little
Bantustans.
Bantustan, correct. And then, but he said no. And then they came again in 10 years later, they would come back to him. So he's how long he's been in prison for, and said, if you renounce violence, you're a free man. And famously said, well, as a prisoner, I mean, I have no say. I need to be free to be able to renounce certain things. You know, so it was, they couldn't put a lid on him.
He was eventually released, and it was probably one of the most famous days in South African, if not world history. And it became, I mean, I remember being a kid. I was 10, 12, and I watched this on TV, and I just knew there was something big going on here. Everyone, everywhere who had a TV in the world was watching this. And he decided, you know, that he would run as ANC president, and eventually was elected as president of the country. He took over from Oliver Tambo, by the way, as ANC president. And he and de Klerk jointly won the Nobel Peace Prize in 1993. And in April of 1994, South Africa went to the polls for its first ever democratic election, and Nelson Mandela was voted and elected our first democratic president.
And one of the things he also famously said, he was relieved that the ANC didn't get more than 66%. He said it would have just created more challenges, and because he so badly wanted it to be integrative and a collaborative. And I think that was his massive strength. Multicultural government.
Yeah. Oh,
it was insane. It was just. He was
by all accounts, this guy was a tremendous negotiator, but hardcore.
Yeah.
Like he could really put his foot down. And there were people who crossed him and made a mistake and never made that mistake again.
But Gareth, what one thing is where you can actually see his personality was, okay, so then now F.W. de Klerk, so, okay, you're released, XXX. So we agree that you're going to be released on Tuesday at 10 a.m. He says, no, I will be released on Wednesday at 10 a.m. So he told them when he's going to be released. I'm not going to be released then. I'm going to be released on that day.
Yeah, I mean, there's so much that we can say in terms of like interesting facts, anecdotal stories, apocryphal stuff that you don't know whether it's true or not. And this is someone who's lived in our own lifetimes. It shows you how history can change in the blink of an eye, and broken telephone sets in. But I think it is fairly clear to anyone who's reading any of the historical information, newspaper articles and the rest of it, that he was managing something quite masterful here. The government of national unity, reintroducing South Africa to the international community, opening up the economy, creating opportunities for people who'd been not only disenfranchised, but had been kept out for their entire lives.
Trying to fix the imbalance, which is
absolutely
actually, we're still struggling.
We're still struggling with it now.
Yeah.
And the ANC may not have been the best vehicle for that, but this guy was extraordinary, exceptional in every way. And he had the world eating out of his hand as well. So we had moral high ground and moral capital to play with. I think that's gone. There's no way we can negotiate at the level that he used to. But that story is magical. And we'll summarize the end of his life, because I don't want to go into too much detail around this. But he stepped down after one term. Again, something African leaders and dictators all over the world are loath to do. Mm. You know, they want to stay around as long as possible.
He's the second term.
Yeah. This, not him.
Yeah.
And Thabo Mbeki did most of the head of government stuff because Mandela was most of his time as president, really the head of state. I mean, he'd take control of some important discussions, but essentially he was our head of state. Thabo Mbeki was our head of government. Mm. And so Thabo Mbeki, you could argue, had three terms or three and two and a bit terms. But, you know, he also has at this point lots of personal issues going on. When he and he divorce, he marries Graca Machel.
Yeah. Well, just the points. There's two quick points on this. So first of all, Graca Machel, you know, we spoke and gushed about Eleanor of Aquitaine.
Yeah.
And she was first the Queen of France and then she was the Queen of England. Graca Machel was basically the
First Lady of Mozambique.
And then the First Lady of South Africa, which is also quite impressive. And she was a very powerful woman in her own right. I think great energy for him in his later life.
Yeah.
But Winnie, there was a lot of challenges with Winnie. She was an activist right throughout. Mm. But I have an own personal anecdote that my father-in-law actually mentioned to me. And she was banished to Brantford.
Winnie.
Yeah.
Yes.
During that time, she needed to, because it's a very small little town and you can't get anything there. So she would then send her driver to, or drivers to Bloemfontein to collect whatever she needed, because it's not far away. And then they would get arrested by the security police all the time. So they would be locked up in jail. And my father-in-law was an attorney and still is practicing an attorney in Bloemfontein. And there, Winnie's lawyer would contact him and, you know, he went and he got them released. And then Winnie would phone my father-in-law, and she was extremely grateful and saying, you know what you've done. Thank you very much. And he said he didn't do it once, twice, three times. He did it a lot. Security police were on
story.
It.
So you see, these are the stories. Yeah. Now, you see, when you get to know these people, when you actually meet the people in history, and this is why I've been reticent to do an episode like this, you get beautiful stories like that. And it colors in a lot of things in a way that we can't do for the others. So it kind of makes those stories from 1100 or whatever else seem so far away and so not human, like they've got superpowers or whatever. But I mean, his lasting legacy is obviously the ongoing democratic institutions that were established during his term as president, our constitution, the Nelson Mandela Children's Fund, the Nelson Mandela Rhodes Scholarships. Mm. He died in December 2013 at the age of, what, 95? He had been ailing for some time at that point, but probably the biggest funeral in South African history that took place then. He's buried in Gqunu on the family farm. I don't think anyone's been allowed to visit the grave except family. It's certainly not open as a tourist attraction. But, you know, this is the greatest man in South African history. I think it's fair for anyone who's looking at the impact of somebody to put him in the top three at very least, but I'd say at number one.
100% agree. I think as well as just during his time when he was released, people were on him, you know, to do this and do that. He was in a Spike Lee movie.
Oh, yeah. No, they weren't. And every celebrity in the world was flying to South Africa to meet him. And it was just exhausting. Poor Zelda, his PA, had the most difficult time just telling people no. Because this is an old man who actually needed to, like, be with his family, eat, sleep, you know, have some time to himself.
Yeah.
Having to meet every famous person who wasn't famous enough yet.
But also awards. I mean,
every award.
I mean, every single thing. There's also controversial, you know, about the Nobel Peace Prize with FW, and there was a little bit of
my least favorite part of talking about Nelson Mandela is the way that revisionist historians have come along now and said he could have done more. He didn't do enough. He wasn't good enough. This guy was a sellout. You know, that's the word you hear sometimes. And this comes from highly uneducated and stupid people. There's no other way to put it.
Yeah, no, 100%
agree. If you were there, I'd like to see you have done a better job.
Yeah, I 100% agree. But I think that obviously the Nobel Peace Prize was the pinnacle, but there was just, it's insane what he did. And a father of our nation, you know, that we are passionate about sport as a nation. He was passionate about sport. He felt that sport could transgress unite all people. And could unite people. And in fact, it really, really did. And whenever I just felt whenever he attended a match, and it actually there wasn't a Springbok match that he did attend that we didn't, that we did not win. So we won all of them.
So he was the magic child.
Yeah, yeah. So then, and then when he when he wasn't attending, I thought, oh no,
it's going to go bad.
Yeah, yeah. So, but well, but effectively, I mean, he was such a great brand ambassador.
I know that this is not objective, but I'm going to quote from the Nelson Mandela Foundation in their line describing him at the end of their biography. Nelson Mandela never wavered in his devotion to democracy, equality, and learning. Despite terrible provocation, he never answered racism with racism. His life is an inspiration to all who are oppressed and deprived, and to all who are oppressed to oppression and deprivation. And I think that's probably more well put than anything I could write.
I can't add to that.
Beautiful. Thanks for listening to this episode of Blind History. Every episode is available on the Cliff Central app, cliffcentral.com, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Cliffcentral.com.